They were so happy when they saw and recognized their little sister, who was now so grown up and lovely. They laughed and they cried, and soon they understood how evil their stepmother had been to all of them.
"We brothers," said the eldest, "fly like wild swans as long as the sun is in the sky. When it goes down, we assume our human form. That's why at sundown we must always have a place to rest our feet, because if we're flying up there in the clouds, we would plunge as humans into the deep. This is not where we live. There's a land just as beautiful as this on the other side of the sea, but it's a long journey. We have to cross the vast ocean, and there is no island along the way where we might spend the night, only a lonely little rock jutting up midway across. There's barely room for us to stand on it side by side. If the sea is rough, the water surges over us, and yet we thank our Lord for it. That's where we can spend the night in our human form. Otherwise, we would never be able to visit our dear homeland, because we must spend two of the longest days in the year in our flight. Only once a year are we allowed to visit the land of our ancestors. We dare stay here only 11 days, flying over the great forest. We can glimpse the castle where we were born and where our father lives, and see the tall tower of the church where mother is buried. Here we feel the trees and shrubs are our kin. Here the wild horses run across the plains the way we remember from our childhood. Here the charcoal burner sings the old songs that we danced to as children. This is our homeland, to which we are drawn, and where we found you, dear little sister. We dare stay here only 2 more days. Then we must fly over the sea to a land that is lovely, though it is not our homeland. How can we take you with us? We have neither ship nor boat."
"How can I set you free?" said their sister. And they talked almost all night long, dozing for only a few hours. Elisa awoke to the sound of swan's wings rushing overhead. Her brothers were once again transformed, and they flew in great circles and were finally far away. But one of them, the youngest, stayed behind. The swan lay his head in her lap, and she stroked his white wings. All day long they stayed together. Toward evening the others returned, and when the sun went down they stood there in their natural form.
"Tomorrow we must fly away from here, not daring to come back for another whole year, but we can't leave you like this. Do you have the courage to come along? My arm is strong enough to carry you through the forest. Shouldn't all of us then have strong enough wings to carry you across the sea?"
"Yes, take me with you," said Elisa. They spent all night plaiting a net from the most supple willow bark and tough reeds, and it was big and strong. Elisa lay down on the net. When the sun came up and her brothers were changed into wild swans, they grabbed the net in their beaks and flew high up toward the clouds with their dear sister, who was still asleep. Rays of sunlight fell across her face, and that's why one of the swans flew above her head, so that his broad wings would give her shade. They were far away from land when Elisa awoke. She thought she was still dreaming, because it seemed so wondrous to be carried over the sea, high up in the air. At her side lay a branch with lovely ripe berries and a bunch of flavorful roots. Her youngest brother had gathered them and put them there for her. She smiled at him gratefully because she could tell that he was the one flying right above her head, shading her with his wings. They were so high up that the first ship they saw below looked like a white gull floating in the water. A great cloud loomed behind them. It was a whole mountain, and on it Elisa saw the shadow of herself and the 11 swans, looking so huge as they flew. It was a painting more magnificent than any she had ever seen, but as the sun rose higher and the cloud fell farther behind them, the hovering shadow picture vanished. All day they flew, like a racing arrow through the sky, yet they moved more slowly than usual now that they had their sister to carry. A bad storm was brewing. Evening was approaching. Anxiously Elisa watched the sun sinking, and still there was no sign of the lonely rock in the sea. It seemed to her that the swans were flapping their wings harder. Oh, it was her fault that they couldn't make fast enough progress. When the sun went down, they would turn into humans, plunge to the sea and drown. Then she prayed with all her heart to our Lord, but still she could see no rock.
The black cloud was coming closer. The strong gusts of wind heralded a storm. The clouds formed one vast, menacing wave that was shooting forward, solid as lead. One lightning bolt flashed after another. Now the sun had reached the rim of the sea. Elisa's heart was trembling. Suddenly the swans shot downward so swiftly that she thought they were falling, but then they were hovering again. The sun was halfway into the water when she first caught sight of the little rock below. It looked no bigger than a seal poking its head above water. The sun was sinking quickly. Now it was no more than a star. Then her foot touched solid ground, and the sun was extinguished, just like the last spark on a burning piece of paper. She saw her brothers, arm in arm, grouped around her, but there was no room on the rock for anything else. The sea pounded against the rock and washed over them like a downpour. The sky glowed in an ever-blazing fire, and thunder crashed, one peal after another. But the sister and her brothers held each other's hands and sang a hymn that gave them solace and courage. At daybreak, the air was clear and calm. As soon as the sun rose, the swans flew off with Elisa, away from the island. The sea was still rough. When they were high in the air, it looked as if the white crests of foam on the greenish-black swells were millions of swans floating on the water. When the sun rose higher, Elisa saw before them, half hovering in the air, a mountainous land with glittering masses of ice on the peaks. And in the midst stood a castle that was surely miles long, with one bold colonnade on top of another. Below swayed palm forests and magnificent flowers, as big as mill wheels. She asked whether this was the country she was going to, but the swans shook their heads. What she saw was Fata Morgana's lovely, ever-changing cloud castle. They didn't dare bring a human inside. Elisa stared at it. Then the mountains, forests, and castle collapsed, and there stood 20 proud churches, all exactly alike, with tall towers and arched windows. She thought she could hear the sound of an organ, but it was the sea she heard. She was quite close to the churches when they turned into an entire fleet sailing beneath her. She looked down, but it was only sea fog racing across the water. Yes, things changed constantly before her eyes. And then she saw the real country she was heading for. Lovely blue mountains rose up with cedar forests, cities and castles. Long before the sun went down, she was sitting on a mountain in front of an enormous cave, covered with fine green vines that looked like embroidered tapestries. "Now we'll see what you dream here tonight," said the youngest brother, showing her to her bedchamber. "If only I would dream how I might set you free," she said, and this thought filled her whole mind. She prayed fervently to God for his help. Yes, even in her sleep she continued to pray. Then it seemed to her that she was flying high up in the air to Fata Morgana's cloud castle, and coming to greet her was the fairy, so beautiful and glittering. Yet she looked very much like the old woman who had given her berries in the forest and told her about the swans with the gold crowns. "Your brothers can be freed," she said. "But do you have the courage and endurance? The sea may well be softer than your delicate hands, and yet it reshapes the hard stones, but it doesn't feel the pain that your fingers will feel. It has no heart, nor does it suffer the fear and agony that you must endure. Do you see these nettles that I'm holding in my hand? Many like this grow around the cave where you're sleeping. Only those, and the ones that grow on graves in the churchyard, can be used. Mark this well. These are the ones that you must pick, even though they will burn blisters into your skin. Crush the nettles with your feet, and you will have flax. That's what you will use to spin and knit 11 shirts of mail with long sleeves. Throw these shirts over the 11 wild swans, and the spell will be broken. But keep in mind that from the moment you begin this work and up until it is finished, even if it takes years, you must not speak. The first word you say will stab like a deadly dagger into the hearts of your brothers. Their lives depend on your tongue. Mark it well." And at that instant, she touched Elisa's hand to the nettles. It felt like a blazing fire and woke her up. It was broad daylight, and close to where she was sleeping lay some nettles like the ones she had seen in her dream. Then she fell to her knees, thanked our Lord, and went out of the cave to start her work. With her delicate hands she reached down into the hideous nettles. They were like fire. They burned big blisters into her skin and arms, but this she would gladly endure if she could free her dear brothers. She crushed each nettle with her bare feet and spun the green flax. When the sun went down, her brothers returned, and they were horrified to find Elisa so silent. They thought it was some new sorcery by their evil stepmother, but when they saw her hands they realized what she was doing for their sake, and the youngest brother wept. Wherever his tears fell, there she felt no pain. There the burning blisters vanished. All night she spent at her task, for she would have no peace until she had freed her dear brothers. All the next day, while the swans were gone, she sat in solitude, but never had the time flown by so quickly. One shirt of mail was already finished. Now she started on the next. Then a hunting horn rang through the mountains. She grew quite frightened. The sound was coming closer. She heard the dogs barking. Terrified, she ran inside the cave, bound the nettles she had gathered and spun into a bundle, and sat down on top of it. At that moment, a huge hound came leaping from the thickets, and right behind came another, and yet another. They were barking loudly, running back and forth. It was only a few minutes before all the hunters were standing in front of the cave, and the most handsome among them was the king of the land. He stepped over to Elisa. Never had he seen a more beautiful girl. "How did you come here, you lovely child?" he said. Elisa shook her head. She didn't dare speak. It was a matter of her brothers' lives and salvation, and she hid her hands under her apron so the king wouldn't see what she had to endure. "Come with me," he said. "You can't stay here. If you're as good as you are beautiful, then I will dress you in silk and velvet, set a golden crown on your head, and you shall live in my richest palace." And then he lifted her onto his horse. She wept, wringing her hands, but the king said, "I wish only for your happiness. Some day you will thank me for this." And then he raced off through the mountains, holding her in front of him on his horse, and the hunters galloped behind. When the sun went down, the magnificent royal city with its churches and domes lay before them. The king led her into his palace, where great fountains splashed in the vast marble halls, where the walls and ceiling were resplendent with paintings, but she had no eyes for any of that. She wept and grieved. Unresisting, she let the women dress her in royal garments, weave pearls into her hair, and pull fine gloves over her burned fingers. When she stood there in all her splendor, she was so dazzlingly beautiful that the court bowed even lower to her. And the king chose her to be his bride, even though the archbishop shook his head and whispered that the beautiful forest girl was surely a witch. She had dazzled their eyes and deceived the king's heart. But the king would not listen. He ordered music to be played, the costliest dishes to be served, the loveliest girls to dance around her, and she was led through the fragrant gardens into the magnificent halls. But not a smile crossed her lips or entered her eyes. Sorrow filled them as her eternal inheritance and possession. Then the king opened a little chamber close to the room where she was to sleep. It was adorned with the costliest green tapestries and looked exactly like the cave where she had been living. On the floor lay the bundle of flax that she had spun from the nettles, and from the ceiling hung the shirt of mail that she had finished knitting. All this one of the hunters had brought along as a kind of curiosity. "Here you can dream yourself back to your former home," said the king. "Here is what you were working on. Now, in the midst of all your splendor, it may amuse you to think back on those days."
End of Disc 3.
When Elisa saw everything that was so close to her heart, a smile played about her lips, and the blood returned to her cheeks. She thought about her brother's salvation and kissed the king's hand. He pressed her to his heart, and ordered all the church bells to proclaim the wedding celebration. The lovely mute girl from the forest was to be queen of the land. Then the archbishop whispered evil words in the king's ear, but they didn't reach his heart. The wedding took place, and the archbishop himself had to place the crown on her head. With evil intent, he pressed the tight circlet so firmly on her forehead that it hurt. But an even heavier band gripped her heart, her sorrow for her brothers. She didn't notice the bodily pain. Her lips were mute. A single word would take her brothers' lives, but in her eyes dwelled a deep love for the kind, handsome king who had done everything to make her happy. With each day she came to love him more, with all her heart. Oh, if only she dared confide in him, tell him of her torment. But mute she had to remain, in silence she had to complete her task. That's why at night she would slip from his side and go into the little alcove that was adorned like the cave. She finished knitting one shirt of mail after the other, but when she started on the seventh, she had no more flax. She knew that the nettles she needed grew in the churchyard, but she had to pick them herself. How was she going to get there? "Oh, what is the pain in my fingers compared to the agony that my heart is suffering?" she thought. "I must attempt it. Our Lord will not abandon me." With fear in her heart, as if she were about to commit an evil deed, she crept out into the moonlit night, down to the garden. She walked down the long lanes, out to the deserted streets, and over to the churchyard. There she saw, sitting on one of the widest headstones, a group of lamias, hideous witches. They were taking off their rags, as if they were going to bathe, and then they buried their long, gaunt fingers in the fresh graves, pulled out the bodies, and ate their flesh. Elisa had to pass close by, and they fixed their evil eyes on her, but she recited a prayer, gathered up the burning nettles, and carried them home to the palace. Only one person had seen her, the archbishop. He was awake while the others slept. Now what he thought had been proven true. Things were not as they should be with the queen. She was a witch. That's why she had deceived the king and all the people. In the confessional he told the king what he had seen and what he feared. As the harsh words fell from his tongue, the carved images of the saints shook their heads as if to say, "That's not true, Elisa is innocent." But the archbishop explained it differently, saying that they were bearing witness against her, that they were shaking their heads at her sin. Then two big tears rolled down the king's cheeks. He went home with doubt in his heart, and he pretended to sleep at night, but no peaceful sleep came to his eyes. He noticed that Elisa got up, and every night she did the same thing. Each time he quietly followed her and saw her disappear into the alcove. Day by day his countenance grew darker. Elisa noticed, but didn't know what it meant, yet it worried her. And what torments she suffered in her heart for her brothers. Over her royal purple and velvet robes ran her salty tears. They looked like glittering diamonds. Everyone who saw the rich splendor wished to be queen. Yet soon she would be finished with her work. Only one shirt of mail remained, but she had no more flax, and not a single nettle. So once again, one last time, she would have to go to the churchyard and pick several handfuls. She thought with fear about the lonely walk and the terrifying lamias, but her will was strong, as was her faith in our Lord. Elisa went out, but the king and the archbishop followed. They saw her disappear through the wrought iron gate to the churchyard. When they approached, the lamias were sitting on a headstone, just as Elisa had seen them. The king turned away, for among them he imagined the one whose head had rested on his breast that very evening. "The people must judge her," he said, and the people decided that she should be burned in the red flames. From the splendid royal halls she was led to a dark, dank dungeon where the wind whistled through the grated window. Instead of velvet and silk, they gave her the bundle of nettles that she had gathered. That's what she could lay her head on. The hard, burning shirts of mail that she had knit would be her comforter and coverlet, but they could have given her nothing more precious. Once again she set about her work, and prayed to God. Outside, the street urchins sang spiteful songs about her. Not a soul comforted her with a loving word. Then, toward evening, there was a rushing sound close to the grating. A swan's wing. It was the youngest of her brothers. He had found his sister. And she sobbed aloud with joy, even though she knew that the coming night might be her last. But now her work was almost finished, and her brothers had come. The Archbishop arrived to spend the last hour with her. He had promised the king to do so, but she shook her head, begging him with her eyes and demeanour to leave. On this night she had to finish her work, otherwise it would all be for naught, everything, the pain, the tears, and the sleepless nights. The Archbishop went away, speaking evil words against her, but poor Elisa knew that she was innocent and went on with her work. Tiny mice ran across the floor, dragging the nettles over to her feet, trying to help a little. A thrush sang next to the window grating and sang all night long, as merrily as it could, so that she wouldn't lose her courage. It was just barely daybreak, not until an hour later would the sun come up, when the 11 brothers stood at the palace gate, demanding to be taken before the king. But they were told this was impossible. It was still night, after all. The king was asleep, and no one dared wake him. They begged, they threatened. The guards came. Yes, even the king stepped outside and asked what was the meaning of this. Then suddenly the sun came up, and there were no brothers to be seen. But over the palace flew 11 wild swans. Out of the city gates streamed the entire populace. They wanted to see the witch burn. A wretched horse pulled the cart in which she sat. They had given her a smock to wear, made of rough sackcloth. Her lovely long hair hung loose around her beautiful face. Her cheeks were deathly pale, her lips were moving faintly, but her fingers were twisting the green flax. Even on the way to her death, she never stopped the work she had begun. The 10 shirts of mail lay at her feet. The 11th she was knitting. The mob jeered her.
"Look at the witch! See how she's muttering! She doesn't have a hymnal in her hand, no. She's sitting there with her odious sorcery. Take it away from her and tear it into 1,000 pieces!"
And they all surged toward her, wanting to tear it to bits. Then 11 swans came flying. They alighted around her in the cart, beating their wings. The crowd drew back in horror.
"It's a sign from heaven. She must be innocent,"
many whispered, but they didn't dare say it aloud. Then the executioner grabbed her by the hand. In haste, she threw the 11 shirts over the swans. There stood 11 handsome princes, but the youngest had a swan's wing in place of one arm, because his shirt of mail was missing a sleeve. She hadn't managed to finish it.
"Now I dare to speak," she said. "I am innocent."
And when the people saw what had happened, they bowed to her as to a saint. But she sank lifeless into her brother's arms, so deeply had the anguish, fear, and pain affected her.
"Yes, she is innocent," said the eldest brother.
And then he explained everything that had happened. As he spoke, the scent of millions of roses began to spread, for every piece of wood in the fire had grown roots and shot out branches. There stood a fragrant hedge, so tall and huge, with enormous red roses. At the very top sat one blossom, white and gleaming, that shone like a star. The king broke it off and placed it on Elisa's breast. Then she awoke, with peace and happiness in her heart. All the church bells began to ring of their own accord. Birds appeared in great flocks, and back toward the palace headed a wedding procession like no king had ever seen before.
The Flying Trunk. Once upon a time, there was a merchant who was so rich that he could pave the entire street as well as a small lane with silver coins. But that's not what he did. He knew of other ways to use his money, and if he spent a skilling, he would take in a dollar. That's the kind of merchant he was. And then he died. His son inherited all the money, and he led a merry life, going to masquerade balls every night, making paper kites out of Riksdaler bills, and skipping gold coins on the lake instead of stones. That way the money could quickly disappear. And it did. Finally, he owned no more than 4 skillings, and had no clothes but a pair of slippers and an old dressing gown. Then his friends no longer cared for him, because they couldn't go out on the street together. But one of them, who was kind, sent him an old trunk and said, "Pack up and leave." Well, that was all fine and good, but he didn't have anything to pack. So he put himself into the trunk. It was a peculiar trunk. As soon as you pressed on the lock, the trunk could fly, and that's what it did. Zip! It flew, carrying him up through the chimney, high above the clouds, farther and farther away. The bottom creaked, and he was terrified that it would fall apart, because then he would have taken quite an impressive tumble. God save us! Then he came to the land of the Turks. He hid the trunk in the forest under some withered leaves and walked back to town. He could easily do that, because among the Turks everyone went around like he did, in a dressing gown and slippers. Then he met a nursemaid with a little child. "Listen here, you Turkish nursemaid," he said. "What is that big castle right near the city, with the windows way up high?" "That's where the king's daughter lives," she said. "It was prophesied that she would become terribly unhappy because of a sweetheart, and that's why no one is allowed to visit her unless accompanied by the king and queen." "Thanks," said the merchant's son. And then he went back to the forest, got into his trunk, flew up onto the rooftop, and crept in through the window to the princess. She was lying on the sofa, asleep. She was so lovely that the merchant's son just had to kiss her. She woke up and was terribly frightened, but he told her that he was a Turkish god who had come to her through the air, and that pleased her. Then they sat side by side, and he told stories about her eyes. They were the loveliest dark lakes, and her thoughts swam around in them like mermaids. And he told her about her forehead. It was a snowy mountain with the most magnificent halls and paintings. And he told her about the stork who brings the sweet little children. Oh, yes, they were lovely stories. Then he proposed to the princess, and she said yes at once.
"But you must come back on Saturday," she said. "Then the king and queen will be joining me for tea. They'll be so proud that I've won the Turkish god. See to it that you know a truly lovely tale, because my parents are especially fond of tales. My mother wants them to be moral and refined, and my father wants them merry to make him laugh."
"Well, a tale is the only bridal gift I'll bring," he said, and then they parted. But the princess gave him a sword encrusted with gold coins, and that was something he could certainly use. Then he flew off, bought himself a new dressing gown, and sat down in the forest to compose a tale. It had to be finished by Saturday, and that was not such an easy thing to do. Finally he was done, and then it was Saturday. The king, the queen, and all the members of the court were waiting with tea in the chambers of the princess. He was so charmingly received.
"Won't you tell us a story?" said the king. "One that is profound and instructive?"
"But one that will also make us laugh," said the king. "Why, of course," he said, and began to speak. Now you'll have to pay close attention. Once upon a time, there was a bundle of matches. They were exceptionally proud of the fact that they were of noble ancestry. Their family tree, meaning the great pine tree, of which they were little sticks, had once been a huge old tree in the forest. The matches now lay on the shelf between a tinder box and an old iron pot, and it was to them that they told the story of their youth. "Yes, when we sat on the green branch," they said, "then we were certainly sitting pretty. Every morning and evening we had diamond tea, which was the dew, and all day long we had sunshine when the sun shone, and all the little birds would tell us stories. We could certainly tell that we were rich because the leafy trees were only dressed in the summer, but our family could afford green clothes both summer and winter. But then came the woodcutters. It was the Great Revolution, and our family was split apart. The trunk won the post of mainmast on a magnificent ship that could sail around the world if it liked. The other branches found other positions, and now it's our job to light the candles for the lowly masses. That's how refined folks like us end up here in the kitchen. Well, things have been quite different for me, said the iron pot standing next to the matches. From the moment I came into the world, I've been scoured and boiled over and over. I take care of practical matters and am actually considered the most important one in the house. My only joy, after the meal, is to stand nice and clean on the shelf and carry on sensible conversations with my friends. Except for the water bucket, which occasionally goes down to the courtyard, all of us always stay indoors. Our only news messenger is the market basket, but it talks so anxiously about the government and the people. Why, recently there was an old pot that was so terrified it fell down and was smashed to bits. And that basket is liberal-minded, let me tell you. You talk too much, said the tinderbox, and steel struck flint so it sparked. Aren't we going to have a merry evening? Yes, let's talk about who's the most refined, said the matches. No, I don't like to talk about myself, said the stoneware pot. Let's have an evening of entertainment. I'll start. I'm going to tell you about something that everyone has experienced. You don't have to think too hard about it, and that's quite pleasant. At the Baltic Sea, by the Danish beech trees... What a lovely beginning, said all the plates. This is bound to be a story we'll like. Yes, that's where I spent my youth with a quiet family. The furniture was polished, the floor washed, and clean curtains were put up every 2 weeks. What an interesting story you're telling, said the whisk broom. You can hear at once that it's a woman talking. There's such an air of cleanliness through the whole story. Yes, you can sense that, said the water bucket, and then he gave a little leap of joy that made a slap against the floor. And the pot continued her story, and the end was just as good as the beginning. All the plates rattled with joy, and the whisk broom took some green parsley out of the sandbox and made a wreath for the pot because she knew this would annoy the others, and she thought, if I crown her with a wreath today, then she'll crown me with a wreath tomorrow. Now I want to dance, said the hearth tongs, and started dancing. Yes, God save us, how she could fling one leg in the air. The old upholstery on the chair in the corner split at the very sight. Could I have a wreath too, said the hearth tongs, and they gave her one. They're nothing but riff-raff, thought the matches. Then the tea urn was supposed to sing, but she said she had a cold. She couldn't sing unless she was boiling. Yet that was sheer snobbishness. She didn't want to sing unless she was standing on the table in the parlour and the master and mistress of the house were there. Over on the windowsill sat an old quill pen that the maid liked to use. There was nothing remarkable about him except that he had been dipped much too far into the inkwell, and that had turned his head. "If the tea urn doesn't want to sing," he said, "she doesn't have to. Outside there's a nightingale in a cage, and she can sing. Of course, she hasn't been trained, but tonight we won't even mention that." "I find that highly improper," said the tea kettle, who was the kitchen singer and half-sister to the tea urn. "Why should we listen to such a foreign bird? Is that patriotic? I'll let the market basket be the judge." "I'm simply annoyed," said the market basket. "I'm more deeply annoyed than anyone could imagine. Is this any way to spend the evening? Wouldn't it be better to set the house in order? Then everyone could take his proper place and I would govern the whole lot. That would certainly be a change." "Oh, yes, let's raise a ruckus," they all said. At that instant, the door opened. It was the maid, so they all stood quite still. No one uttered a peep. But there wasn't a pot that didn't know what it was capable of and how refined it was. "Yes, if I wanted to," they each thought, "this would certainly have been a merry evening." The maid picked up the matches and lit them. God save us, how they crackled and burst into flame. "Now anyone can see," thought the matches, "that we are the most important. What a radiance we have! What light!" And then they burned out.
"That was a lovely tale," said the Queen. "I felt as if I were right there in the kitchen with the matches. Yes, you shall marry our daughter."
"Yes, of course," said the King. "You shall marry our daughter on Monday."
And they used the informal means of address, because he was going to be part of the family. The wedding day was now decided. And on the evening before, the whole city was lit up. Pastries and rolls were tossed to the crowds. The street urchins stood on their toes, shouting, "Hurrah!" and whistling through their fingers. It was all so magnificent. "Well, I suppose I ought to see about doing something too," thought the merchant's son. And so he bought rockets, firecrackers, and all the fireworks imaginable, put them in his trunk, and then flew with them high into the air. Whoosh! How they flared! How they crackled! All the Turks jumped so high that their slippers flew up around their ears. They had never seen such a vision in the sky. Now they understood that it was the Turkish god himself who was to marry the princess. As soon as the merchant's son came back down to the forest with his trunk, he thought, "I want to go to town to hear what kind of impression I made." And that was quite a reasonable wish. And how the people did talk! Every single person he asked had his own version, but everyone agreed it had been lovely. "I saw the Turkish god himself," said one person. "He had eyes as shiny as stars and a beard like foaming water." "He flew in a cloak of fire," said another. "The loveliest cherubs were peeking out of its folds." Yes, he heard lovely things, and the next day would be his wedding. Then he went back to the forest to get into his trunk. But where was it? The trunk had burned up. A spark was left from the fireworks, the trunk had caught fire, and now it lay in ashes. He could no longer fly, no longer reach his bride. She stood all day long on the rooftop and waited. She is still waiting, while he roams the world telling stories, though they're no longer as merry as the one he told about the matches.
The Nightingale. In China, as you probably know, the emperor is Chinese, and everyone around him is Chinese too. This story happened many years ago, but that's precisely why it's worth hearing, before it's forgotten. The emperor's palace was the most magnificent in the world, made entirely of fine porcelain, so costly but so fragile, so delicate to the touch that you had to be extremely careful. In the garden you could see the most wondrous flowers. Tied to the most splendid of them were silver bells that jingled, and you couldn't walk past without noticing the flowers. Yes, everything was quite artful in the emperor's garden, which stretched so far that even the gardener didn't know where it ended. If you kept on walking, you would come to the loveliest forest with tall trees and deep lakes. The forest went right down to the sea, which was deep and blue. Great ships could sail right under the branches. And among the branches lived a nightingale who sang so blissfully that even the poor fisherman, who had many other things to tend to, would lie still and listen whenever he heard the nightingale as he pulled in his fishing nets at night. "Dear Lord, how beautiful she sounds," he said. But then he had to go back to his work and forget about the bird. Yet the next night, when she sang again and the fisherman appeared, he would say the same thing. "Dear Lord, how beautiful she sounds." Travellers came from countries all over the world to admire the emperor's city and the palace and the garden. But if they happened to hear the nightingale, they all said, "That's the best thing of all." The travellers would talk about everything when they went back home, and the learned men wrote many books about the city, the palace, and the garden, but they didn't forget the nightingale. She was esteemed above all else. Those who could write poetry wrote the loveliest poems, every single one about the nightingale in the forest by the deep sea. These books circulated around the world, and one day some of them even reached the emperor. He sat on his golden chair, reading and reading, as he kept nodding his head, because it pleased him to hear the magnificent descriptions of the city, the palace, and the garden. "Yet the nightingale is the best of all," he read in the book. "What's this?" said the emperor. "The nightingale? I know nothing about it. Is there such a bird in my empire, let alone in my own garden? I've never heard of her. To think I had to learn about her from a book." And then he called for his Lord Chamberlain, who was so refined that if anyone lower in rank dared speak to him or ask him about something, his only reply was, "Puh," and that means nothing at all. "Supposedly there is a truly extraordinary bird here called the nightingale," said the emperor. "They say that she's the best thing in all my vast domain. Why hasn't anyone told me about her?"
I've never heard her mentioned before, said the Lord Chamberlain. She has never been presented at court.
I want her to come here tonight and sing for me, said the Emperor. The whole world knows what I have, but I do not.
I've never heard her mentioned before, said the Lord Chamberlain.
I'll search for her. I'll find her.
But where was she to be found?
The Lord Chamberlain ran up and down all the stairs, through the halls and corridors. Not a single person he met had ever heard mention of the nightingale. So the Lord Chamberlain ran back to the Emperor and said that she must be a fable concocted by those who write books.
Your Imperial Majesty should not believe what people write. It's all fabrication and what's called black magic.
But the book I was reading was sent to me by the mighty Emperor of Japan, said the Emperor. So it must be true. I want to hear the nightingale. She must be here tonight. I bestow on her my highest favour. And if she doesn't come, then all the members of the court will be punched in the stomach after they've eaten their supper.
Ring pe, said the Lord Chamberlain.
And once again he ran up and down all the stairs, through all the halls and corridors, and half the court ran along with him because they didn't want to be punched in the stomach. Everyone was asking about the remarkable nightingale that was known to the whole world, but to no one at court. Finally they came upon a poor little girl in the kitchen, and she said,
"Oh, Lord, the nightingale, I know her well. Yes, how she can sing. Every evening I'm allowed to take home a few scraps from the table for my poor sick mother. She lives down near the shore, and when I walk back feeling tired, I take a rest in the forest, and then I hear the nightingale singing. It makes my eyes fill with tears. It's as if my mother were kissing me."
"Little kitchen maid," said the Lord Chamberlain, "I shall arrange a permanent post for you in the kitchen, and permission to watch the Emperor eat, if you can lead us to the nightingale. She has been summoned here tonight." And so they all set off for the forest, to the place where the nightingale usually sang. Half the court went along. As they were walking, a cow began to moo.
"Oh," said the royal squires, "now we've found her. What remarkable power for such a small creature. We're quite certain we've heard her before."
"No, those are the cows mooing," said the little kitchen maid. "We're still quite far from the place."
Now the frogs began croaking in the bog.
"Lovely," said the Chinese court chaplain. "Now I can hear her. It sounds just like little church bells."
"No, those are the frogs," said the little kitchen maid. "But I think we'll hear her soon."
Then the nightingale began to sing.
"There she is," said the little girl. "Listen, listen. And there she sits."
And then she pointed at a little grey bird up in the branches.
"Is it possible?" said the Lord Chamberlain. "That's not at all how I imagined her. How plain she looks. She must have lost her colour from seeing so many refined people all around."
"Little nightingale,"
cried the little kitchen maid in a loud voice.
"Our most gracious emperor would like so much for you to sing for him."
"With the greatest pleasure," said the nightingale, and sang so it was sheer delight.
"It sounds just like glass bells," said the Lord Chamberlain. "And look at her little throat. She's singing with all her might. It's strange that we've never heard this bird before. She will be a huge success at court."
"Shall I sing some more for the Emperor?"
asked the nightingale, who thought the Emperor was among them.
"My splendid little nightingale," said the Lord Chamberlain, "I have the great pleasure of summoning you to a royal celebration this evening, where you will enchant His Exalted Imperial Grace with your charming song."
"My song sounds best out in nature," said the nightingale, but she willingly went along with them when she heard that this was the Emperor's wish.
At the palace, everything had been properly cleaned and polished. The walls and floors, which were made of porcelain, gleamed with thousands of golden lamps. The loveliest flowers, the ones with bells attached, had been placed in the corridors. There was a draught and a great commotion making all the bells ring. You couldn't hear yourself think. In the middle of the great hall where the Emperor was seated, a golden perch had been placed, and that was where the nightingale was to sit. The entire court was present, and the little kitchen maid had been given permission to stand behind the door, since she now held the title of Real Kitchen Maid. Everyone was dressed in his very finest, and everyone was looking at the little grey bird to whom the emperor nodded. And the nightingale sang so wondrously that tears filled the emperor's eyes. Tears rolled down his cheeks, and then the nightingale sang even more beautifully. The song went straight to the heart. The emperor was so happy that he said the nightingale must wear his golden slipper around her neck. But the nightingale thanked him and said that she had already received reward enough. "I've seen tears in the emperor's eyes. For me that is the richest treasure. An emperor's tears have a wondrous power. God knows that is reward enough." And then she sang again in her sweet, blessed voice. "This is the most lovable coquetry we've ever known," said the women all around, and then they put water in their mouths in order to cluck whenever anyone spoke to them. They thought they too could be nightingales. Even the lackeys and chambermaids announced that they were satisfied, and that is saying a great deal because they're the most difficult of all to please. Yes, the nightingale certainly was a success. Now she would stay at court and have her own cage, as well as the freedom to promenade twice a day and once at night. 12 servants were sent along, each of them holding tight to a silk ribbon attached to her leg. There wasn't the least bit of pleasure in those excursions. The whole city was talking about the extraordinary bird. If two people met, one of them would say to the other, "Night," and the other would say, "Gale," and then they would sigh, fully understanding each other. Why, 11 grocers' children were named after her, but not one of them could even carry a tune. One day a big package arrived for the emperor. On the outside it said, "Nightingale." "Here we have a new book about our famous bird," said the emperor. But it wasn't a book. A little work of art lay inside the box, a mechanical nightingale that was supposed to look like the live one, although it was completely encrusted with diamonds, rubies, and sapphires. As soon as they wound up the mechanical bird, it sang one of the tunes that the real bird sang, and its tail moved up and down, glittering with silver and gold. Around its neck hung a little ribbon, and on it were the words, "The Emperor of Japan's nightingale is paltry compared to the Emperor of China's." "It's lovely," they all said, and the person who had brought the mechanical bird was at once given the title of Supreme Imperial Nightingale Bringer. "Let's have them sing together. What a duet that will be." And then they had to sing together, but it was not a success, because the real nightingale sang in her own way, while the mechanical bird ran on cylinders. "There's nothing wrong with that," said the music master. "It keeps perfect time, and is obviously a follower of my own methods." Then the mechanical bird had to sing alone. It brought just as much joy as the real bird, and on top of that it was much more charming in appearance. It glittered like bracelets and brooches. 33 times it sang the very same tune, and yet it never grew tired. Everyone could have listened to it all over again, but the emperor felt that the live nightingale should also sing a little. But where was she? No one had noticed that she had flown out the open window, off to her green forests.
"Well, what sort of behaviour is that?" said the emperor.
And all the members of court began scolding, saying that the nightingale was a most ungrateful creature. "Yet we have the best bird of all," they said. And then the mechanical bird had to sing some more, and that was the 34th time they heard the same tune. But they didn't yet know it by heart, because it was so complicated, and the music master lavished great praise on the bird. Yes, he assured them that it was better than the real nightingale, not only in terms of its attire and the scores of lovely diamonds, but also internally.
"For you see, ladies and gentlemen, and above all your Imperial Highness, you can never count on what will come out of the real nightingale, but with the mechanical bird everything is certain. This is how it will sound, and no other way. You can explain it. You can open it up and demonstrate the human reasoning, how the cylinders are arranged, how they operate, and how one turns the other."
"Those are my thoughts exactly," they all said. And the music master was granted permission on the following Sunday to display the bird to the people. They too should hear it sing, said the emperor. and they heard it and were as pleased as if they had drunk themselves giddy on tea. That was so typically Chinese. And everyone said, "Oh," and held up in the air the finger that we call pot liquor, and then they nodded. But the poor fisherman, who had heard the real nightingale, said, "It sounds nice enough, and it does look quite like it, but something is missing. We don't know what." The real nightingale was banished from the realm. The mechanical bird had its place on a silk pillow close to the emperor's bed. All the gifts it had been given, gold and precious stones, were spread around it, and in title it had risen to supreme imperial nightstand singer. In rank it was number one on the left, because the emperor considered the side of the heart to be the most noble, and even in an emperor the heart is on the left. The music master wrote 25 volumes about the mechanical bird, books that were so learned and so lengthy, and written in the most difficult of Chinese words, that everyone said they had read and understood them, because otherwise they would have seemed stupid, and then they would have been punched in the stomach. A whole year passed in this fashion. The emperor, the court, and all the other Chinese people knew by heart every little cluck of the mechanical bird's song, but that was precisely why they liked it above all else. They could sing it themselves, and they did. The street urchins sang, "Shi, shi, shi, cluck, cluck, cluck," and the emperor sang it too. Oh, yes, it was certainly lovely. But one evening, when the mechanical bird was singing its best and the emperor was lying in bed and listening, it went clunk inside. Something burst. Bzzz, all the gears spun around, and then the music stopped. The emperor sprang out of bed at once and called for his royal physician, but what good could he do? Then they summoned the watchmaker. After much discussion and a great deal of study, he managed to get the bird working fairly well, but he said that it would have to be played sparingly because the cylinder pegs were worn out. It would be impossible to replace them with new ones so that the music would play properly. That was a terrible shame. Only once a year did they dare let the mechanical bird sing, and even that was almost too often. But then the music master gave a little speech using big words and said that it was just as good as new, and so it was just as good as new. 5 years passed, and the whole land suffered a great sadness, because everyone was truly very fond of their emperor. Now they said he was ill and about to die. A new emperor had already been chosen, and the people stood outside on the street and asked the Lord Chamberlain how things were going with their emperor. "Puh," he said, and shook his head. Cold and pale, the emperor lay in his big, magnificent bed. The entire court thought he was dead, and all of them had run off to greet the new emperor. The valets had run outside to talk about it, and the palace maids were holding a big coffee party. All around in the halls and corridors, cloth had been laid down so that no one's footsteps could be heard. That's why it was so quiet. So quiet. But the emperor was not yet dead. Rigid and pale, he lay in the magnificent bed with the long velvet curtains and the heavy gold tassels. High above, a window stood open, and the moon was shining on the emperor and the mechanical bird. The poor emperor could hardly breathe. It felt as if something were sitting on his chest. He opened his eyes and saw that it was Death sitting on his chest. He had put on the gold crown and was holding in one hand the emperor's gold sword and in the other his magnificent banner. All around in the folds of the great velvet bed curtains, peculiar heads were sticking out, some of them quite horrid, others so blessedly gentle. They were all of the emperor's good and bad deeds looking at him now that Death was sitting on his heart. "Do you remember this?" one after the other whispered. "Do you remember this?" And then they told him so many things that the sweat poured from his brow. "I never knew that," said the emperor. "Music! Music! The great Chinese drum!" he shouted. "So I won't have to listen to everything they're saying." But they kept on, and Death nodded, as the Chinese do, at everything that was said. "Music! Music!" screamed the emperor. "You blessed little golden bird, sing now, sing! I've given you gold and precious things. I myself have hung my golden slipper around your neck, so sing now, sing!" But the bird stood silent. There was no one to wind it up, and otherwise it couldn't sing. But Death kept on looking at the Emperor with his big, empty eye sockets, and it was so quiet, so horribly quiet. At that moment, close to the window, the loveliest song was heard. It was the live little nightingale, who was sitting on a branch outside. She had heard about the Emperor's distress, and that's why she had come, to offer solace and hope. And as she sang, the figures grew more and more pale, the blood began to flow faster and faster through the Emperor's weak limbs, and Death himself listened and said, "Keep singing, little nightingale. Keep singing."
"Yes, if you give me the magnificent gold sword. Yes, if you give me the opulent banner. If you give me the Emperor's crown."
And Death returned each treasure for a song, and the nightingale still kept singing. She sang of the silent churchyard where the white roses grow, where the fragrant elder tree stands, and where the fresh grass is watered by the tears of the bereaved. Then Death had such a longing for his own garden that he floated out like a cold white fog out the window.
"Thank you, thank you," said the Emperor. "You heavenly little bird, of course I recognize you. You're the one I chased from my realm, and yet you have sung the evil visions away from my bed and driven Death from my heart. How shall I reward you?"
"You have already rewarded me," said the nightingale. "I won tears from your eyes the first time I sang. I will never forget that about you. They are the jewels that make a singer's heart glad. But sleep now, and grow strong and healthy. I will sing for you."
And she sang. The Emperor fell into a sweet slumber, so gentle and refreshing was his sleep. The sun was shining through the windows when he awoke, strong and healthy. None of his servants had yet returned, because they all thought he was dead. But the nightingale was still sitting there, singing.
"You must stay with me forever," said the Emperor. "You shall only sing when you want to, and I will smash the mechanical bird into 1,000 pieces."
"Don't do that," said the nightingale. "It has done the best it could. Keep it as you always have. I can't live in the palace, but let me come whenever I wish. Then in the evening I will sit on the branch by your window and sing for you, to make you both joyous and pensive. I will sing about those who are happy and those who suffer. I will sing about the evil and the good that is kept hidden from you. The little songbird flies far and wide, to the poor fisherman, to the farmer's rooftop, to everyone who is far from you and your court. I love your heart more than your crown, and yet the crown has a scent of something sacred about it. I will come. I will sing for you. But one thing you must promise me."
"Anything," said the Emperor, standing there in his imperial robes, which he had donned himself, and holding the sword that was heavy with gold pressed to his heart.
"One thing I ask of you. Tell no one that you have a little bird who tells you everything, and things will go even better."
And then the nightingale flew off. The servants came in to tend to their dead emperor. Oh, yes, there they stood. And the Emperor said, "Good morning." The Sweethearts. A top and a ball lay in a drawer among the other toys, and then the top said to the ball, "Why don't we be sweethearts, since we're lying here in the drawer together?" But the ball, which was made of Morocco leather, and had as high an opinion of herself as an elegant lady, refused even to reply to such a suggestion. The next day the little boy who owned the toys came in. He painted the top red and yellow, and pounded a brass tack into the middle of it. The top looked quite magnificent when it spun around. "Look at me," the top said to the ball. "What do you say now? Shouldn't we be sweethearts? We suit each other so well. You leap, and I dance. No one could be happier than the two of us."
"Oh, is that what you think?" said the ball. You don't seem to realize that my father and mother were Morocco leather slippers, or that I have a cork in my middle.
Yes, but I'm made of mahogany, said the top, and the judge himself made me. He has his own lathe, and he did it with the greatest of pleasure.
Am I really supposed to believe that? Said the ball.
May I never be spun again if I'm lying, replied the top.
You present yourself well, said the ball, but even so, I can't. I'm almost as good as engaged to a swallow. Every time I fly up in the air, he sticks his head out of the nest and says, will you? And now I've inwardly said yes, and that's almost as good as an engagement. But I promise that I'll never forget you.
Well, that's a big help, said the top. And then they said no more to each other. The next day the ball was taken out. The top watched as she flew high up in the air, just like a bird, until she was out of sight. Each time she came back down, but she always made a big leap when she touched ground. And that was either from longing or because she had a cork in her middle. The ninth time the ball disappeared and didn't come back. The boy looked and looked, but the ball was gone.
I know where she probably is, sighed the top. She's in the swallow's nest and is married to the swallow.
The more the top thought about it, the more entranced he became with the ball, precisely because he couldn't have her. That's why his love kept growing. The fact that she had taken another was the strange thing about it. And the top danced and spun around, but he was always thinking about the ball, who in his thoughts grew more and more beautiful. Many years passed in this fashion, and by then it had become an old love. And the top was no longer young, but then one day he was gilded all over. He had never looked so splendid. He was now a golden top, and he leaped until he hummed. Oh, yes, he was quite something. But with one leap he went too high, and he was gone. They looked and looked, even down in the cellar, but the top was nowhere to be found. Where was he? He had jumped into the trash bin, where all sorts of things lay, cabbage stalks, sweepings, and rubble that had fallen from the eaves.
Well, this is certainly a fine place to be. The gilding will soon come right off me. And what sort of riffraff have I landed among?
Then he cast a sidelong glance at a long cabbage stalk that had been picked too clean, and at a strange round object that looked like an old apple. But it wasn't an apple. It was an old ball that had lain for many years up in the eaves with water seeping through it.
Thank God that someone my equal has finally arrived. Someone I can talk to, said the ball, looking at the gilded top. I'm actually made of Morocco leather, stitched together by maiden hands, and I have a cork in my middle, but no one would know that by looking at me. I was just about to celebrate my wedding to a swallow, but then I landed in the eaves, and that's where I've been for 5 years, seeping water. That's a long time, let me tell you, for a young lady.
But the top didn't say a word. He was thinking about his old sweetheart. And the more he listened, the more he felt sure that this ball was his sweetheart. Then the maid came to empty the trash.
Hey, here's the golden top, she said.
And the top was brought back to the parlour with great ceremony, but nothing was heard of the ball. And the top never said another word about his old love, which fades when your sweetheart has lain in the eaves for 5 years, seeping water. Why, you wouldn't even recognize her if you met her in the trash bin.
The Ugly Duckling. It was so lovely out in the country. It was summer. The rye was yellow, the oats green. The hay had been gathered in stacks down in the green meadows. That's where the stork was walking around on his long red legs, speaking Egyptian, because that was the language he had learned from his mother. Surrounding the fields and meadows were great forests, and in the middle of the forests were deep lakes. Oh yes, it was truly lovely out in the country. In the midst of the sunshine stood an old estate with a deep moat all around. From the walls and down to the water grew huge dock leaves that were so tall that little children could stand upright under the largest of them. It was just as wild in there as in the thickest forest, and this was where a duck was sitting on her nest. She had to sit there to hatch her little ducklings, but now she was getting tired of it all because it was taking such a long time, and she rarely had visitors. The other ducks were more fond of swimming around in the moat than running over to sit under a dock leaf to chat with her. Finally, one egg cracked open after the other. "Peep, peep," they said. All the egg yolks had come alive and were sticking out their heads. "Quack, quack," she said, and they all rushed out as fast as they could and looked all around under the green leaves. Their mother let them look as much as they liked, because green is good for the eyes.
"How big the world is," said all the youngsters,
because now they had quite a bit more room than when they were lying inside the eggs.
"You think this is the whole world?" said their mother. "It stretches far away to the other side of the garden, all the way to the pastor's field, although I've never been that far. But you're all here now, aren't you?"
And then she got up.
"No, I don't have all of you. The biggest egg is still lying here. How long is it going to take? I'm getting very tired of this."
And then she sat down again.
"So, how's it going?" said an old duck who came to visit. "One egg is taking such